Hello and welcome back to the WTF1 podcast with your usual host, myself, Hayden Geist, and of course, the incredible James Coker that is alongside me today. Now, it's a new week, which means we ask the age-old question that we've been asking for so long since the start of the season. Has Adrian Newey signed with a different team yet?
Will we see green smoke from the Vatican?
Green smoke. And our sources from the BBC, they posted it. Sky Sports have also posted it and said that it is confirmed that he has signed a contract of up to 5 years as reported to be around $30 million a year. Now, it's not fully signed, sealed, delivered, announced across the whole world, but very similar to how Lewis Hamilton was announced on Sky Sports News before it was actually announced by Ferrari and Mercedes. I feel like it's a scenario that's going to be wrapped up very quickly.
Right. BBC reported 2 days ago on September 7th that Newey was signing with Aston Martin for a deal up to 5 years for up to £30 million a year. Sky Sports just announced it 2 hours ago. So it's Monday morning at 10 a.m. in Los Angeles for me. So they announced it at 8 a.m. Los Angeles time. That would be math is hard. 4 p.m. London time. So, if it's being announced by BBC and it was just announced by Sky Sports, and an official announcement from Aston Martin and from Formula One, it must be imminent, right?
Yeah, it's got to be coming. Like I say, very similar to how, you know, Sky Sports reported like 9 a.m. in the morning, UK time, I think it was, or 8 a.m. When Ferrari were signing Lewis Hamilton, he was going there, but it wasn't like announced by anyone else. It was just, and Sky Sports, you know, was so sold on this going ahead that they were like, we're going to say that it is confirmed and it is happening. And I think it's a very similar situation. I mean, it's one of those rumors that, you know, everyone has pretty much kind of clued onto by now. Maybe there's a few, you know, people still on the old copium trying to hope that he's still going to Ferrari or maybe little old Williams. But, you know, I think it's pretty much certainty that he's going to be going to Aston Martin. You know, there's a lot of money there, and Aston Martin have the ambition to want to buy and put the money into people like Adrian Newey to get them in the team to build the car possible. So I think, you know, it's surely got to happen before Baku, where we finally get that F1 graphic and it is finally fully confirmed by every publisher.
If and when Aston Martin officially makes this announcement, you know how they should do the hard launch of Adrian Newey to Aston Martin? They should recreate that scene from The Lion King where Rafiki is holding Simba up on the top of Pride Rock. So we go to like a high point, whether it's at like Aston Martin's headquarters or on some like tall building in London, and we have Lawrence Stroll hold Adrian Newey up in front of the crowd. And then we have Fernando Alonso or Lance Stroll get on the microphone and go, Nigoyama Bagadi ba ba ba.
You went so loud then that I could not hear the first part. You went so loud that the Discord call we're calling in right now said, nope, I'm not even going to attempt to try and send that over the wavelengths. But yes, I'm fully down for that. Yeah, I will happily be one of the animals in the background bowing to Adrian Newey at the top of the rock. Get me there.
To get the lyrics right, I had the lyrics from The Circle of Life in front of me to try to do it.
Oh, you have the whole lyrics, do you? Well, I mean, now we're going to have to hear the rest of the song, right?
I don't think we have time. But very excited. Hopefully we get an official announcement very soon. We probably will get an official announcement the second we stop recording this podcast. But it feels imminent. Aston Martin domination is so close. Maybe a year away, maybe 2 years away. Probably 2026 when the new regulations drop.
And then Lance Stroll is going to be like, you're all laughing at me, but you're not laughing now, as he's just, you know, throwing pole positions and race wins at everybody, right?
That's going to happen. He's going to be spraying everybody with Ferrari Trento, and then he's going to pull out a bottle of maple syrup and just be spraying maple syrup everywhere.
Oh, could you imagine if he actually did that? Like, he got the champagne, he just poured the maple syrup into the champagne and started. I wonder what that would taste like, actually. Surely that's got to be nice.
Too sweet.
Mm, I don't know. I've watched Elf, and Buddy the Elf says that maple syrup goes with everything. So it's got to go with champagne as well.
Moving on, I feel like real quick, and I know other people have talked about this, but I feel like we as fans, you and I, Hayden, as well as the lovely people listening to this podcast, whether you are listening out of love or listening out of hate, can we all just have a quick reality check here? Because I feel like sometimes it is very hard to see the forest from the trees, and it is very hard to appreciate something like this season when you are in the middle of it. Because I think a lot of people are going to go back and look at what's going on this season and be like, wow, that was one of the best seasons of Formula One in the last few decades. Let's just run it down real quick. Let's break it down. We have 7 different race winners so far from 4 different constructors. We have Leclerc winning his home race finally in Monaco. We have a Ferrari win at Monza. We have the first career win for Lando Norris. First career win for Oscar Piastri. An emotional home race win for Lewis Hamilton at Silverstone and his last British GP for the Silver Arrows. We have a very close fight for the Constructors' Championship. It looks like McLaren's going to overtake. They're now the favorites for the Constructors' Championship, but we don't know what could happen. Red Bull could end up holding onto it. We'll see. And then we have a closer or close-ish fight for the Drivers' Championship. We have George Russell yelling Yabba Dabba Doo. we have Max Verstappen, who like all of a sudden appears to be mortal and also like maybe a little more mature. We have a driver switch mid-season at Williams, 3 rookies announced in silly season, a race ban, and a partridge in a pear tree.
And a partridge in a pear tree, exactly. And you know, I think we've taken the hit of such a dull and boring 2023 where we had 3 different race winners from only 2 different teams. No changes. The first time ever, Formula One, the whole grid stayed exactly the same between 23 and 24. And it was just like, you know, the whole sigh of the Netherlands just going, at the end of that season. You know, and I think then we've been rewarded by enduring such torture and pain by getting such a cracker season. I don't think people are talking as much and like hyping up this season as much as maybe 2021 was hyped up, because of course, we haven't got 2 drivers battling it out head to head every week and just switching positions in the drivers' championship. And obviously,
right,
you know, there's a lot of us at the moment, I'm one of those included, that thinks we're going to have a championship battle at the end of the season. I do think the Red Bull drop-off is going to continue. I don't think they're going to be able to change this thing overnight. And it makes sense with the way the cost cap regulations have come in and the testing time, that Red Bull have less time to upgrade their car. Obviously, they could be more efficient with their upgrades for sure, but they have less time to do that. Whereas the likes of McLaren, Ferrari, Mercedes have more time to make those upgrades and then to close up the gap. And I think, you know, I think it is going to close up, and you've now got Red Bull and you've got 4 very close teams, Red Bull being potentially, you know, on the back of it. We saw in the last race in Italy that the Red Bull were like the 4th best team in the sport now. And that is crazy to think. And, you know, if that continues, it does flip so quickly. And if McLaren can get the thing sorted out and start putting their drivers in positions where they both can win and, you know, can push for that driver's championship, then it is going to come down to the end and it is going to be playing catch up and it might work out. So I think we will look back at it at the end of the season. I think if it has a championship battle, it will be looked upon even greater than it is at the moment, of course. I don't think there are as many people talking. Like I say, there's not a championship battle right now, but if there does become one, then it's going to be right up there, one of the best seasons in Formula One, because it has just been absolutely crazy. But what it does set us up for is potentially an incredible 2025 with 4 teams all very much on par. And if Aston Martin can sort out their shit, then they can get straight in that battle as well. And then we've got a 5-way.
We got a 5-way? Have you ever been in a 5-way, Hayden?
Don't want to disclose that information.
Well, we, as you know, us Formula One fans, we love 5-ways. As you all know.
Well, there's 10 cars as well, so that's a 10-way. That's even better. Well, who am I kidding? Sergio Perez doesn't get involved. Okay, 9-way. 9-way.
Do you think partially a lot of Formula One fans are still numb or maybe suffering a hangover from last season, and that's why a lot of people have not been able to appreciate this season so far?
I think a lot of people have dropped off. I think a lot of fans have gone since 2021. I think a lot of people came in because it was a lot of talk. And of course, it's going to be talked about. You've got Max Verstappen, this young hotshot, about to overthrow the establishment, you know, the established driver of Lewis Hamilton. But you've also got Lewis Hamilton going for that record-breaking eighth. So there was someone to support if you were jumping on this bandwagon in 2021.
Yeah.
Either you go for this driver who's going to create history and be the first ever driver to get 8 world championships, or you go for the considered underdog and the one who's about to topple, you know, that established driver. So there was something for people to jump onto. 2022 started off with a lot of promise. You know, Charles Leclerc versus Max Verstappen, back and forth every single race. You know, the start of 22 season was incredible because they were fighting pretty much every race. And then it dropped off. 23 was so boring. And I think those new fans who are more casual have been like, well, this is boring. Why do I want to watch a race where the race winner is 30 seconds off down the road? And we've lost those fans. And I know some of the older generation would be like, well, they're not hardcore fans then, because you look at some of those old school races and there were people winning by laps, like, you know, winning by 30 seconds was a common denominator of Formula One. But I do think, you know, with the shorter attention spans of people these days with social media platforms like TikTok and Instagram, like, if there's not something going on, then people aren't interested. And I think that's definitely happened with Formula One. But we've definitely had some great people that have stayed over. I'm not saying that everybody's left. But I think we are, you know, currently in this stage where, because there's not a championship battle, there's nothing to pull people back at the moment. It's like, all the races are really, really exciting. We've got a new winner every single time. But I think you need that championship battle, that battle up at the front for the title to bring people back in.
So you think in order to create a really compelling season for the masses, instead of their wins being spread out, you really think you need like two top contenders going toe-to-toe?
I don't think you necessarily need two top contenders, but you need contenders at the top. You need people fighting for the championship. Because, you know, we have had races in the past where we have incredible battles for second place and all this, but people don't remember those races because they look at it at the end of the day and say, Max Verstappen, Lewis Hamilton, Michael Schumacher, whoever you want to name, was 30 seconds off down the road, you know, destroying everybody. So people didn't tune in till the end of that race because some people don't care about that battle past first position. They want to see the battle for the win, whether that be the race or whether that be the championship. And I think, that eventually is what it's come to. You know, if we have back and forth, you know, between drivers, that doesn't just have to be two people. That could be the five-way that I'm talking about. You know, it could be back and forth between five drivers. We had an incredible end to the season in 2010, where there were like five drivers in contention going into the last three rounds or something like that. And that was exciting. But as long as you have that for the championship, then I think that draws newer fans in. It gives a reason for people to watch. It gives them a reason to talk about, because people are talking about it week on week. Oh my God, Max Verstappen's just overtaken Lewis Hamilton next week. Lewis Hamilton's just got back the championship lead off this incredible drive. Max Verstappen dominated this weekend. Hamilton fell off and he's back. So yeah, I think that's kind of where Formula One needs to take, and hopefully that's what 2025 is going to provide. And this is just a little short. This is the teaser. This is the teaser trailer, and the movie's coming out next season.
So this is like the appetizer. These are the past apps.
Exactly.
At the party before you sit down for the full meal.
Fully, fully.
I love that. The hors d'oeuvres. I love it. Well, these are some delicious hors d'oeuvres. I can't wait to see what the full spread is. Moving on, Audi recently announced that they have adjusted to more realistic targets for 2026 when they come in as a full works team, when they take over Sauber's operation. I think originally when they announced their entry into Formula One, I think they had more lofty aspirations, more ambitious goals when they started. And I think as they've started to develop their project, they've had to pull back and kind of maybe temper expectations a bit. Where along the lines do you feel like it is important to be transparent about what your expectations are? Or do you think it's better to be DeLulu?
I think if you're going to have big expectations, I feel like it's good to be transparent of how you're going to do those. And I always talk about this, and people are probably bored about being like, why is he always going about Aston Martin and their ambition? And it's because it makes more sense to the general audience, and you can tell them how we are trying to get there. You can say, you know, our ultimate goal is to win the championship. And I think for a lot of these teams coming in, a lot of these big brands, Audi is what a big brand, and I think their ambition is to win the championship. So you've got to ask that question, okay, so how are you going to do that? Aston Martin were very much like, we're going to build a massive campus. We're going to, you know, make sure we get the best staff that we can possibly get and give them the best tools to make the best car. And then that's how we're going to try and win the championship. I think for Audi and their expectations, you know, when the Audi project was kind of brought about, you know, it was around 22, 23, and Alfa Romeo Sauber were in a decent position. You know, they weren't, you know, running away and winning races or whatever. They were still in that back marker pack, but at least they were regularly scoring points, I would say, on the back end of scoring points. Whereas, you know, Stake have taken over and it's just really not worked out as we go on to these regulations. And they've just fallen off more and more as the weeks go on. You know, we started off with the start of the season and they were, you know, setting pit stops that were 30 seconds long. I saw a graphic for the average pit stops for all teams this season. Most teams high, I think the ninth position team was like 3 seconds. Stake Sauber is 6 seconds is their average pit stop. That's how much it shafted them at the start of the season.
Well, okay, but are they throwing out the outlier stops, like the 50-second stops? Are those in that average?
No, I'm pretty sure those are in that average, but that was an expectation for Stake Sauber at the start of the season. It wasn't just a one-off for them. You know, for Stake Sauber, yeah. that was like the amount of bad stops that Valtteri got was horrendous. And I think the expectations have to be pulled back a little bit because, you know, they're taking over Stake and it's not just overnight. Okay, winter break's done. We're now a top team. Welcome to Audi. We're going to be winning races. No, it's going to be a long, hard project to drag that team back up and be able to build the correct car to get back in. Obviously, 2026 is a refresh and it's a great chance for them to obviously come back, but I think it will take a lot of time.
And part of my ignorance here, do you think part of the, because you sort of see the quality across the board at Sauber be sort of below par, even in the midfield when you compare them to other midfield teams, with the quality of the car, but also the timing and the pit stops. Do you think part of that sort of drop in quality, can any of that be attributed to the fact that Sauber is based out of Switzerland? And you know, then you have two teams in Italy and then the rest of the teams are in the UK. Is it harder to recruit and retain talent to come to Switzerland as opposed to being, for instance, in the UK where the majority of the motorsport world is headquartered?
I think potentially. I mean, I think motorsport is quite popular over in the UK and there's a lot of people who go through, you know, but I can't necessarily speak from experience because I don't know what it's like in other countries. You know, obviously Italy has a high passion for Ferrari. And if there are people wanting to get on the Ferrari project, then they go through, they will go through probably the RB team in Maranello. Not Maranello, where are they? Is Maranello?
Fienza. Fienza. RB's in Fienza.
Fienza, yeah. That's it. Maranello's obviously Ferrari. So obviously they go through that, but there are quite a lot of people that go through the Sauber team who are Italian as well. There's still people left over from the Alfa Romeo days and Stake, of course, are utilizing Ferrari engines. There is a bit of a partnership there between the two of them. So I'm not too sure how much in terms of personnel that still equates to, but yeah, is Switzerland a prospect for people to go and work for a team there? I can't answer that because I generally have no idea, but there are so many intelligent people around the world and so many people who are crucial for these roles in Formula One, and they can come from any country. So I don't think it particularly matters too much because, you know, you're going to have, you know, Swiss engineers, German engineers, maybe a couple from little old Luxembourg that are near to it as well, French, you know. So there's a lot of diversity in Formula One in terms of nationalities. Obviously, a lot of the teams based in the UK certainly definitely helps, and it definitely helps when people who live already in the UK, have got a family there, might go, oh, I want to stay in the UK and I want to go to a UK team instead. Obviously, I suppose there's a bit more of a challenge there to move people out of their family life, I would say.
Yeah, like kind of like when a lot of people speculate that one of the reasons Newey said he didn't want to go to Ferrari is because he didn't want to go to Italy, wanted to stay in the UK. So could be a factor. I want to go back to talking about Aston Martin for a second. Because I think it's so interesting that you constantly refer to Aston Martin as a team that is slowly developing the building blocks to be a really competitive team. The way you describe them reminds me of the 2010 and early 2020 Philadelphia 76ers in NBA. Okay. I don't know how familiar you are with basketball. Are you familiar with basketball?
Okay. Not a Scooby. You carry on. I will put two and two together.
In the mid-2010s, the Philadelphia 76ers announced a plan known as The Process. This started around like 2012, 2013. And The Process was an acknowledgement that they were in a rebuilding phase and they were not going to be good right away. They might not be good for a few years, but they were slowly putting in the building blocks to build a championship team and win an NBA championship. Because the 76ers have been in the NBA for a long time. They're a historic franchise. And so they started by drafting pieces that they felt like long-term could be a championship team. And that was all centered around Joel Embiid. Do you know who Joel Embiid is?
No.
He's 30 years old, center, plays for the 76ers, is one of the best players in the NBA. Has been an NBA regular season MVP before. Is from Cameroon, but also is American, and also has, I believe, some French in his family. And so he has played for a bunch of different countries, but he played for USA in USA basketball. So anyway, I digress. The process was all about building this team around Joel Embiid to not be able to compete right away, but in a few years, they're all playing together. They become like this unit that knows the intricacies of one another and can play as a cohesive unit as opposed to just plugging a bunch of stars in. I feel like Aston Martin is doing something very similar that what the 76ers did with The Process, and Fernando Alonso is their Joel Embiid.
Yeah.
So like their first step in creating a championship team was signing him in 2023 and then slowly but surely starting to poach technical talent from other teams, either offering them promotions or more money, you know, upgrading their facilities to the point where, I don't know, in 4 or 5 years, they're going to be competing for constructors and drivers championships.
Yeah, I fully back that. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I think a lot of teams do that. And I think I know obviously Williams are a lot further off that, but that's very much James Vowles' approach as well, where it's like, look, I'll be completely honest with you lot. We're not going to be a championship winning team anytime soon. There's a lot of problems here. We've got to tear things up and we've got to rebuild anew. But we are aiming to get back there, and this is how we're going to do this. And obviously, you know, James Vowles has bought two incredible good drivers into Williams, Alex Albon and Carlos Sainz now going there. So I think there's ambitions there. With the Aston Martin project, of course, you know, you've got a lot of people that, and I know they've taken a back step this season. And I think there was an engineer, I can't remember his name, but he came from Red Bull. He went over to Aston Martin, and I'm pretty sure he brought a lot of what Red Bull had on the car over to Aston Martin. They were really quick last season. And then obviously, I don't think they fully understood the car they were making. And this season, they've gone back to the drawing board, started fresh, and are going to make something from the ground up again that's sort of more competitive in all areas, and something that they can build upon and have a proper development process with the car. But I think also last season was really good for a lot of the team personnel to motivate them and also show them what it's like to be in a regular podium position and how much fun it is to be regularly fighting up at the front, getting on the podiums and popping champagne every single week. And then to come back to, you know, reality, back down to, you know, the bottom end of P10, which is where they were, I think, in 22, is to show them, if you want this again, you need to work hard for it. And, you know, we work hard, we can get back up there, and we're going to do everything that we can to get back up there for you guys. But you also need to make sure that you work hard as well to help us get back up to it. I think that they can do it.
And so 76ers fans and 76ers brass, like the people in the front office, would constantly say, trust the process. Mm-hmm. If fans were upset about a bad game or a bad result, they'd say, trust the process, trust the process. And in Spanish, the process is el proceso. But you know what we've heard a lot of recently, especially last season, was talks of el plan.
El plan.
So we need to trust the plan.
As long as it doesn't turn into an L plan, then we're all good. We're all happy.
So in Spanish, confía en el proceso.
Is that what Fernando's saying every single week?
Yeah, or confía en el plan.
It's actually what the social media team say to Fernando when they ask him to do the bizarre things on his TikTok page.
Exactly. love it. Cool. So next up, over the weekend, we had some very sad news in the world of Formula One. Alan Rees passed away at the age of 86. Some newer fans might not be familiar with him. He was a former driver, but he's mainly known because he co-founded March Engineering, managed Shadow in the 70s, and also co-founded Arrows Grand Prix International in 77, which ran in Formula One in one form or another for a few decades. And I just feel like it's important to acknowledge people like Alan Rees and their contributions to Formula One, because often we only tend to talk about drivers and team principals, and we forget how many people it takes to not just make an individual Formula One team run, but also Formula One as a sport function. It requires so many people and so many different from so many different departments, like when we talked about Sid Watkins last week. Mm-hmm. So just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge Alan Rees.
Yeah, March, I'd say a successful team in Formula One, started in 1970 all the way up until 1992. Was actually one of the first teams that Niki Lauda drove for in Formula One, brought him into the sport. Only achieved two race victories with the Works team. They were also a chassis supplier to a lot of other teams as well, including Williams, Hesketh, Tyrrell in the early days as well. But I think, you know, it's just... really, really important to highlight these people, as you have said, that Formula One would not be the sport without those people behind the scenes. And I think we should always acknowledge the history of it, look back on what has happened before, and not forget those names, not necessarily just of the team, because I think a lot of people listening might not know of the March team, and it was actually turned into Leighton House March, which I'm pretty sure is the team that Adrian Newey designed one of his first Formula One cars for as well. So a lot of people, you know, wouldn't have jobs without this team.
You know what's really interesting? I'm surprised this has not happened in Formula One. And maybe this is partially on the fans' shoulders, partially on the sports' shoulders. I'm surprised we don't know more of the team members, especially in the garage on race days. Now, I know a lot of like hardcore fans know the people who do strategy for certain teams, like for instance, like Hannah Schmitz at Red Bull, and formerly Ruth Buscombe, who was at Alfa Romeo, aka Steak/Sauber. And you know, most of us know who the team principals are, but like, why do we not know who like the front jackman is? Why do we not know who the like right rear gunner is for the tires? Like, I'm surprised that we aren't more familiar with all of the teams.
Yeah, I mean, I can kind of understand why Formula One necessarily doesn't highlight it as Formula One, but I'm surprised how maybe some of the teams don't. And I know a lot of teams do have vlogs behind the scenes. I remember McLaren used to have the Unbox series, which I don't think is there anymore. I'm not too sure if they've continued it. Maybe they have. I haven't tuned into it for quite a while. But I thought it was a really great series, and you did see behind the scenes, and you do have these regular occurring characters, but you know, without really getting to the names, and you see that on, you know, I'm sure a lot of people here will also have tuned in at some point in their lifetime to vlogs and watching people's lives, and you get to know not only that person that you are watching, but also their friends they hang around with consistently, and you get to know those as characters as well, because essentially that's what really a lot of people kind of are in this world. When you're watching them, whether you're watching them on your phone or on your TV, they are characters, and you know, they have their own personalities and their own lives and their own backstories, so to speak. And you know, I think it is something that potentially teams should unlock and dive into. And I don't just mean boring sit down talk, piece to camera, who are you, tell me who you are. No, I just mean generally just have someone go round the facilities. And yes, okay, there's parts that will have to be hidden, but you've got a blur. There's a blur effect on After Effects and Premiere Pro. Like, you can get that out and blur things. It's not a problem.
Just
as long as you're not disrupting people's day at work, I suppose. But yeah.
Have you ever seen an NFL broadcast before?
Rarely. I mean, the one-off Super Bowl, but then I fall asleep because it's far too late for me.
So at the beginning of a game, they'll do a starting lineup announcement. Like, while the game is happening, you'll see a little graphic at the bottom of the screen, and you'll see the head of each player saying their name and either what position they play or what college they went to. So it'll be like Zach Martin, center, University of Notre Dame. CeeDee Lamb, wide receiver, University of Oklahoma. I would love to see that at a Formula One race. I would love them to, over the course of the race, go to each garage and you see a little graphic and it's like,
well, you can always have it,
front Jackman.
When the pit stops do happen, obviously it's focused on one team's pit stop. So you're watching Lando Norris come into the box and it has on a side somewhere, a better graphic designer knows where to place this, but you have somewhere situated of, faces and names.
Faces and names. Exactly. I would love that.
The only problem is, if somebody makes a slow pit stop, you just know that person's going to get annihilated. And then, unfortunately, now they've got a name. There's always, social media is always such a downside to things. There's so many good things about it, but there's always such a downside to it that, you know, I hate that I have to think about the negative of it. But yeah, I know that someone there is going to do it.
Usually you only find out their name when they fuck up.
Yeah.
For sure.
But if you already know the name going into it as well, then you know exactly, be like, oh, this person is an absolute... You know, when it's a mistake that every, you know, front right wheel man has done in their life.
Are you familiar with John O'Brooks at McLaren?
I am not.
So he still works at McLaren, but he now works with the development of the car. Director of F1 build at McLaren Racing, John O'Brooks. And we'll talk about this some other episode because I want to talk about this show more in depth. But if you watch the Amazon show before Drive to Survive came along, there was a show on Amazon called Grand Prix Driver. And Grand Prix Driver is four episodes. Each episode is 30 minutes long. And it covers the 2017 season of McLaren Racing when they go from the start before preseason testing, getting the car ready for preseason testing, and then it ends after preseason testing. You don't see any of the season. And it's not really covered like Drive to Survive, and that, you know, Drive to Survive likes to craft certain narratives, and some stuff is maybe blown out of proportion or enhanced for entertainment value. This is like a more cut and dry documentary, but they talk about this guy, John O'Brooks, who now is the director of F1 build at McLaren. John O'Brooks used to be in the garage, and he tells a story about in 2010, when Jenson Button at the time, at the beginning of the season, was leading the championship and they were in Monaco, and John O'Brooks forgot to take a bung out of the side pod before the car went to the grid. And in the formation lap, the car overheated and it either DNS'd or DNF'd like very early in the race. And he had to take the fall for it. He admitted it. But like, I think people knew who he was because of that mess up.
Yeah.
That's not how you want to be. You want people to learn your name. But I still think, I don't know. I feel like highlighting and knowing the other members of the team in the garage, I think would just expand the world even more and make it more interesting, in my opinion.
Yeah. And also for those people involved, you know, you can have the pictures, whatever, you know, but if you're on the F1 broadcast and your name's there and there's a graphic with your name and your face on it, oh, that is, you know, you walk into the pub with all your friends, you're like, that's right.
Yeah, it's fun.
I'm the man now. I'm the man. Drinks on
me. Especially if you got the fastest pit stop that day.
Next round's on me, but only only the cheapest beer. We're not made of money here, right? Not champagne. Stay away from that.
What's the cheapest beer in the UK?
Depends where you are. I mean, you go to London, there's no cheap beer. It's expensive. I don't know. There's probably some really dirty stuff. I can't remember what it was called. Like something Jack's, I think it was called. That was horrible when basically I started first drinking. I don't know. I don't know what it was called, but it was terrible and it was cheap and it was just what everyone was sort of drinking when you like, you know.
The cheapest the cheapest beer you can drink in the US is called Natty Ice or Natty Light, and or Natural Ice or Natural Light, but everyone calls it Natty. It is disgusting.
Yeah.
It tastes like you're drinking like metal shavings. It is so gross. And the reason that's so cheap is that like it's made by Anheuser-Busch, who also makes Bud Light and Budweiser. Mm-hmm. And they produce the beer in these giant vats. And at every different level of the vat is a different quality of beer. And what they bottle and can in Natty Ice and Natty Light is like the bottom. It's like what's left over when they make the other shit. And it's so bad. But people buy it because it's cheap. Yeah. Like college kids drink it.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it's the same. You know, when you first start drinking, when you become of age, definitely, is when you first start drinking. There's also, so not necessarily beer, but I remember going on like lads' holidays when I first like out of sixth form.
I don't know what a lad's holiday is.
A lad's holiday is going to basically just a party place, which is just, Magaluf is a very popular place for UK people to go. Mali is another one. And it is just basically drinking non-stop.
It's just guys being dudes.
Obviously it's not just for guys. There are also a lot of girls there as well, but it's more so,
well, why
guys.
Is it not called a lads and lasses holiday?
I don't know mate, I have no idea, but that's just where it is. I think because if some girls, if they're going, they don't want to tell people that's where they're going on holiday. But
is this the British equivalent of spring break?
I don't know, because it's not something that's necessarily like every year. I feel like it's something you do when you leave sick form before you go to uni. It's something that a lot of people kind of do.
So it's like that. The Amish equivalent of a Rummerspringer.
Yeah, I don't know what that is, but yeah, I'm going to agree.
Let me educate you. Do you know what Amish people are?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You know, they like, you know, they in the, you know, I don't know if they have them in the UK, but like in the States, Amish people like live on a farm and they have big beards and they don't really use electricity and they churn their own butter and they're very religious and they make their own furniture and stuff. All Amish people are allowed to go on a thing called a Rummerspringer.
Okay.
Which a Rummerspringer, it is like a rite of passage during adolescence for Amish people. And they're essentially allowed to leave like their community and explore the world. And the usual like behavioral restrictions that you have as an Amish person are thrown out the window, and you're allowed to like go do whatever you want, and you're allowed to get it out of your system. And then you're supposed to come back and be Amish for the rest of your life. So it's like, essentially this, you're like, I call in the United States, I call it your sophomore year of life. Like most people have a sophomore year of life. A lot of people go to college. They have like 1 or 2 years where they're crazy. They're drinking a lot. Yeah. They're partying a lot. They're, you know, hooking up with a lot of people, and they get it out of their system and then they sort of settle down.
Yeah.
This Rummerspringer happens like over the course of a few weeks. It's like the Amish people's one opportunity to go out and be wild.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'd say it's quite similar then. And I would say, yeah, it's basically people who are over there. You're either, it's kind of like clubbing in the UK now. I don't go clubbing anymore because if on the rare occasion I have been out, like say a mate's stag do or whatever, and you've just gone out, it's either people who are from the ages of 18 to 22-ish, or your 40s and beyond. So you've got those who have just started getting allowed to go clubbing, or the recently divorced. And I'll back out, you know, and that is exactly what Magaluf is like. And
that is so sad. Places.
If you want to know about it, a great film and a great English program in between us, if you've ever watched it. But there's a film.
I haven't.
So it started off as a series based off these people during like sixth form, which is just before you go to uni. And then the film is where they go off on a lad's holiday, and it's basically, if you want to know what it's about, in between this movie, great film, but great bit of English culture for you. But yeah, to come back to off a little tangent, I went out there and I drank this thing called Rushkinov vodka, and it's basically very famous that you get a Rushkinov cough because it is such cheap vodka that it basically ruins your throat and you will sound like you've smoked about 60 a day for the next 2 weeks because it's that bad. And I generally think, because I've done three of those holidays now, that I cannot drink vodka ever again in my life without me feeling ill, because it's just done that to me. Going online without ExpressVPN is like not closing the door when you use the bathroom. Even if you think you have nothing to hide, why give random creeps a chance to invade your privacy? All of your internet traffic, yes, all of it, even including mobile network providers, flows through your internet service provider's servers.
And here in the US, they're legally allowed to sell your data to advertisers. ExpressVPN can stop this. They reroute 100% of your internet traffic through secure encrypted servers, blocking your ISP from seeing your browsing history, which I love, because sometimes at 3 a.m. I'm searching, like, can I get a Muppet of Dame Judi Dench? And I don't want want other people knowing. What? Oh, Bernie Eccleston. I don't want people knowing that I'm looking for like a puppet version of Dame Judi Dench. Maybe I want to recreate some of her favorite performances in my garage by myself and let that be like a private moment for me, you know? But there's plenty of VPNs, we hear you yell. ExpressVPN is the one to go for. It's easy to get going with one simple tap to get protected, and it works on all devices from phones, tablets, and laptops. But if our recommendation isn't enough, it's been rated number one by best tech reviewers such as CNET and The Verge. So protect your online privacy today by visiting expressvpn.com/WTF1. That's expressvpn.com/WTF1. And you can get an extra 3 months absolutely free. expressvpn.com/WTF1.
So to come back to Formula One for this very strange, you got a book haul. You went shopping for some books.
I did. So my wife and I went out of town this weekend. For people listening, if you don't know or if you care, I live in Los Angeles. We decided to go to Ojai for the weekend for my wife's 40th birthday. We stayed at a very nice place called the Ojai Valley Inn, like very bougie resort. And we had lunch in this small cafe. You know who was sitting next to us, Hayden?
Enlighten me.
Sir Anthony Hopkins.
No way.
Yeah, swear to God.
I actually know who that person is for once.
You'd be impressed. But we were very starstruck, but yeah. We played it cool. I only looked over at him once. Jenny stared at him a lot, and he caught her staring at her. But I've heard that he is a lovely individual, and it was very, very cool. So we went to the Ojai Valley Inn. It was lovely. We then went to this bookstore. That's an outdoor bookstore in Ojai called Bart's Books.
Okay.
And it's a used bookstore. And I was like, oh, let me go over to the sports section and let me see what I can find. Let me see if there's any like cool motorsport books. The first book is not necessarily a motorsport book, but it is a racing book. It is called Soapbox Derby Racing by Sylvia A. Rosenhall. Are you familiar with Soapbox Racing?
Yeah, I know Red Bull do a Soapbox big Derby event now, don't they?
Yeah.
I guess, obviously, it originated from something a bit more than just the Red Bull Soapbox event. But
Soapbox Derby is a youth-oriented soapbox car racing program that started in Dayton, Ohio, or started in the United States by Dayton, Ohio native Myron Scott. And it started in 1914 and for a long time, started in 1934. So it's 90 years old. And it's like, I think for a very long time, the Soapbox Derby was a big tradition in the United States. I don't know if it's as big as it used to be, but the reason I bought this book is that I opened it to the first page and the Soapbox Derby, Los Angeles County Soapbox Derby champion, or Soapbox Derby was happening near where I live. Okay. I live in Burbank in Los Angeles. And the intersection, I'm not going to say for privacy reasons, is very near where I live, which is wild.
So,
but yeah.
We're going to need to see a soapbox very soon.
Yeah, we got to buy one. But it's interesting because Soapbox Derby, like,
might be the purest form of racing because it's motorless. It's all about how you build the chassis, right?
Yeah, I suppose so. Make sure that it doesn't fall apart. And it's not gonna, no wheels are gonna break easily. Or you just Freddy Flintstone it and you just yabba dabba do like George Russell and run off with the victory.
And the next book I found, which I thought was funny, is Mansell and Williams, The Challenge for the Championship. Okay. This is like a nice coffee beautiful table
car.
Book.
My favorite car.
Beautiful car. The Red 5?
My favorite car. Yeah, 100%. The FW14B is just, oh, love it.
Yeah. So I got this book. It's written by Nigel Mansell and Derek Alsop, which means it was written by Derek Alsop. And maybe Nigel Mansell like loosely dictated some of it, but it was he definitely didn't write it. Let's be real.
He doesn't seem like much of a... This is the book. Are you happy with it? Didn't read, just went, okay.
Didn't even read it. Like Nigel Mansell seems like a lovely guy. Doesn't seem like a writer though. So
He's from Birmingham. They don't read there. Don't worry about that. Just
and so, even though Nigel Mansell's credited as a writer, let's be real. It was all written by Derek Alsop, right? Yeah. So I just want to read a quick page of it. You just give me a number from 1 to 162. Give me a number.
69, baby.
All right, 69. Here we go. And there's a lot of beautiful photos of the Red 5 in this, by the way.
Yes.
This is a good book. I should send you this. I think you'd like this book.
There will be some sticky pages then.
Okay, here we go. 69. And here, I'm going to show you the pictures because I'm going to treat this like preschool and it's like I'm reading to children. Here are the photos.
Yes. And I'm sat down for story time now. I love this.
Yeah. If technical decisions have to be made, Patrick comes in. If pressure has to be exerted on any of our suppliers because things are not up to standard or on schedule, that's Frank's department. He is the only one who can handle that, and he handles it extremely well. While the mechanics are working on the cars, the engineers are consulting, and the tire men are sorting out our supply with Goodyear. I will get through around 20 sets of tires over the weekend. Our partners from Renault are organizing themselves too. They bring to each race 7 engines. Another 3 are sent to Williams in advance, and those 3 are in the cars. 2 new engines are kept back for the race. After the race, all 10 engines are returned to Renault's factory to be stripped and examined. Renault's technicians set up their banks of computers in a corner of our garage. Here, they can monitor the performance of the engines out on the circuit through telemetry equipment. Wow, this reads like a children's book. Yeah,
that is crazy, though, that they bring along 7 engines for a race weekend. Of course, you had 3 cars.
You had the
spare car. But still, 7 engines, you know, that it was just the way they were allowed to go through as many engines as possible back then compared to obviously nowadays.
But I thought that was a fun book. So yeah,
I like that.
I'm going to have to find a way to get it to you. It's probably expensive to ship a book to the UK, but maybe I can buy one in the UK that gets sent to your
and we can both have story time together. Home. I can
or
read
I'll buy one
you.
In the Netherlands and I'll send it to your girlfriend.
Yes, perfect. But
speaking of a third car, have we, you and I ever talked about the documentary One Life on the Limit?
I don't think I've watched that. What's it about?
Okay, there is an amazing Formula One documentary called One Life on the Limit. It came out. It's narrated. It came out in 2013. It's narrated by Michael Fassbender.
Okay.
Pretty famous actor. Don't know if you know him. Like, I think in the UK, you can watch it on Apple TV if you have Apple TV.
Yeah.
This documentary is very well done. But the opening scene of One Life on the Limit starts on, I believe, the Australian Grand Prix in 1996. Anyway, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the opening of the documentary starts at the 1996 Australian Grand Prix. And on the very first turn, Martin Brundle totally crashes his car. Like, it's really bad.
Yeah.
Like, it flips over and he eventually gets out. But it, like, in any other instance, you could have thought he was really, really hurt. And he gets out of the car and he seems fine. And he kind of, like, brushes off, like, you know, debris or whatever, and looks around and he sees that there's a red flag. And because there's a red flag, that means they're going to do a full race restart from the starting grid, like a standing, full standing restart. And when he realizes that,
he remembers that they have a third car. So he starts sprinting to find Sid Watkins. Yeah. This is a great scene. I gotta find it and send it to you. So he starts sprinting all over the track looking for Sid Watkins. Finds Sid Watkins, and he's like, "Hey, can you clear me to get back in the car? Can you clear me to get back?" And Sid's like, "You all right?" And like asks him a couple questions. And he's like, "Yeah, okay, go." And so Martin Brundle then sprints back to the garage, and he's like, "All right, I need another set of gloves. Like, somebody give me my helmet." Hops in the third car and starts the race. But it was like, it's such a badass scene.
Yeah.
Because Martin Brundle just almost died.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first thing he wants to do is get back in a car and do it again.
Yeah. It's like the 1998 Belgian Grand Prix, where there's that massive crash at the start and you just get so many of them just sprinting back to be like, you know, to get in that spare car as soon as possible. Do I think spare cars should come back? I kind of want it, you know.
I think it'd be so fun. I think they absolutely should have a third car.
But they're
also called a T car, I think.
Yeah, it kind of gives, like, I don't know. Some people be like, "Oh yeah," but it gives you like get out of jail free card, or what if there's two teammates who both crash out? Who's going to get it? I mean, that's up for the team to decide. But you know,
I love it. It's like real life Uno.
Yeah. It's just one of them actually holds up an Uno reverse, and it's like, "I want a spare car." It's like, no. It's my time, buddy.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. Last segment. I think we should just do my thing, and then we could save your other thing.
Yes,
for
we'll save my game that Baku.
Love special. It. So college football just started. We're now in week. I think we just had week two of college football. And how familiar are you with college football?
No idea, but I do know what surprised a lot of people is that college football is more popular than the NFL. I'd say. Right? More stadiums than actual NFL games, which is just crazy.
It's wild. So last week, Hayden compared Formula One teams to English Premier League clubs, which I thought you nailed it. And so this week, I'm going to compare Formula One teams to college football teams. Let's get right into it. Ferrari, this is a no-brainer. Ferrari 100% is the University of Alabama.
Okay.
Both are red, even though they're different reds. Ferrari is more scarlet. Rosa Corsa, Alabama is crimson. But Alabama is one of the most successful programs of all time, especially in more recent history, is the most successful college football program. They just dominate. And when everybody thinks of like a benchmark for excellence in college football, they think of Nick Saban, who just retired, and they think of Alabama. They're also one of the most hated teams. So it tracks. Like, huge fan base, also hated, very successful. Ferrari is Alabama. Now, next up, I have McLaren as Michigan, the University of Michigan. University of Michigan historically was very successful. And until last year, when they won the national championship with Jim Harbaugh as their coach, they had dropped off quite a bit, and they hadn't met expectations either for their fans or for college football fans in general. So I put McLaren as the University of Michigan. Williams, I have as the University of Notre Dame. Are you familiar with Notre Dame?
No. Where's Notre Dame?
University of Notre Dame historically is one of the most successful college football teams of all time.
Okay.
They're one of the most iconic college football programs of all time, but they have not been good in a long time.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm putting Williams as Notre Dame. Now, if Ferrari is Alabama, Haas is another University of Alabama team, but it's the University of Alabama, Birmingham. And they're not the Crimson Tide. They're the Blazers, which is a dragon.
Okay.
So the UAB Blazers are a newer college football team, and they're not very good. So that's where I put them there. Next, I have Alpine as the University of Florida, because both of them were really good in the 2000s. University of Florida had Tim Tebow. Do you know who Tim Tebow is?
No idea.
He was a college legend of the United States.
I feel like I'm letting you down a lot. Like, do you know this person?
Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. In the 2000s, University of Florida was so good, so popular, But they have not been very competitive and very good since the 2000s, similar to Alpine / Renault. And also in their small corner of the world, both teams have rampant fan bases, right? You go to France, of a sudden you're surrounded by Alpine Renault fans.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're not in France, you're like, does Alpine have any fans? Now, Sauber is the University of Oregon. And I only say that because Sauber is constantly changing their name. Like, okay, we could go through how many different times Sauber has changed their name.
Sauber's had Sauber, it's had BMW Sauber, back to Sauber again, then Alfa Romeo, and then Steak, I think, is their name changes.
Here we go. Team Sauber, Broker Sauber, Mercedes, Sauber Mercedes, Red Bull Sauber Ford, Red Bull Sauber Patronus, Sauber Patronus, BMW Sauber F1 Team, Sauber F1 Team, Alfa Romeo Sauber F1 Team, Steak F1 Team, Kick Sauber. So you've had Sauber change their name so many different times. They have like a identity crisis or a cash flow problem. We don't know. Sauber constantly changes their name. The University of Oregon constantly changes their uniforms.
Okay.
I don't know if you know this about the University of Oregon, but they have a different uniform for every single game. Oh, and they've been doing that for years. Yeah. They they have like a jersey or uniform design person like on full time roster, or they rotate or something. They have a different uniform every single game. It's insane.
Do they just do insane shirt sales? Is that what they do?
Maybe they might. So they're also Phil Knight, who's the founder of Nike, is a big supporter donor to the University of Oregon. So the University of Oregon has really deep pockets because they have Nike money and they have like this Nike partnership. So I'm going to say Sauber's Oregon only because Sauber changes their name a lot and Oregon changes their uniforms a lot. Dumb comparison, but that's what we're going with. Now, Red Bull is the University of Miami because both have a reputation for maybe bending the rules a little bit. Mm-hmm. And typically they are disliked.
Okay.
And they also, both teams have fans, but you've probably never met one. Next up, Visa Cash App RB is a JUCO team that has a bunch of amazing players that academically weren't eligible to play for a top university. Now, do you know what a JUCO team is?
No, enlighten me.
JUCO team is a junior college team.
Okay.
So United States has a JUCO system where you have a lot of junior college teams that have incredible players who like aren't smart enough to get into a university. So because RB is a junior team to Red Bull, I'm going to say that they're a JUCO team that has a bunch of amazing players that academically couldn't get into the University of Miami. We're just going to go with it,
so,
all right?
So, Yuki Tsunoda and Daniel Collie, you're just not smart enough, chaps, all right? You're just not
That's
smart
not
enough.
What I said. That is not what I said. Next up, Mercedes is, I never know when I do these comparisons to other sports, I never know where to put Mercedes because, like, they're a newer team, but they were also a very successful team. Yeah. So, I'm going to put them as Ohio State University, successful, but not historically as successful as the other top three teams. Although, if I were to compare a like for like to Toto Wolff in college football, I would say Jim Harbaugh, who was the coach of the University of Michigan, because Toto Wolff and Jim Harbaugh both give like zaddy vibes.
Okay.
And then I'm going to say that Aston Martin is a fictional team, AKA the Texas State University Fighting Armadillos. From the 1991 comedy Necessary Roughness. Are you familiar with this movie?
No idea, but I like
you gotta watch it. It's so good. So they're from the 1991 comedy film Necessary Roughness because both teams' star players are 43-year-old rookies. And in the movie, their starting quarterback is 34 years old.
Okay.
And I know Fernando's 43, but it's similar enough.
Yeah, I mean, just switch the two numbers around.
Yeah.
And you got exactly the same.
Both teams have old rookies. that's why I put them there. So Aston Martin is the Texas State University Fighting Armadillos from the 1991 film Necessary Roughness.
I like that.
I think that's all the teams.
You've absolutely smashed that. I knew.
How about, do you know? You don't know any fatigue.
I knew about 75. No, that's 25% of those words. But you said them so convincingly and so articulately that, you know, I'm like, yeah, I fully agree.
That's what's so interesting about the English language, because we could be speaking the same language but be from very different parts of the world, and it's like a totally different dialect, right? Yeah.
100%. And I think that is a very, very good place for us to end on. And we're going to be back later on in the week to speak about Baku. So everything that is coming up with Baku, you've got Ollie Bearman coming back to Haas, what the track is like, what are our expectations going in. Make sure you tune into that one later on in the week. So you've got to go follow whatever audio platform you're currently listening to right now. Hit that follow button right now. Make sure you check both myself out and James over on social media. And of course, follow the official WTF1 channels on the socials. And we will see you later on in the week for a Baku preview. Until then, have a good rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Bye.